From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And it's time for our reporter roundtable, where we talk about what's making news across the 21st state. In today's roundtable, we're going to be talking about Macomb and Galesburg, as well as Bloomington Normal. Joining us now is Jane Carlson, regional reporter for Tri-States Public Radio, whose stations include WIUM-FM in Macomb. Jane, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Also with us, Lindsay Jones, a reporter at WGLT, Bloomington Normal Public Radio. Lindsay, welcome back to The 21st Show to you as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Jane, I want to begin with you. And there is a judge. This is pretty rare. There's a judge in Adams County who is being removed from service by the Illinois Courts Commission. What happened there?
Well, Robert Adrian, he'd been an Eighth Circuit judge since 2010, was removed from the bench last week by the Illinois Courts Commission, and his judicial misconduct stems from a sexual assault case in Adams County. So he was presiding over a bench trial in the fall of 2021, and he found an 18-year-old guilty of sexual assault of a 16-year-old. But then at the sentencing in January of 2022, he did acknowledge that there was a mandatory prison sentence for that crime, but he said he wasn't going to sentence him. He said that he thought the 18-year-old had served enough time in county jail, so he reversed the conviction and said he was not guilty. The second thing in that case was shortly after he reversed the conviction, he threw a prosecutor out of his courtroom because the prosecutor had liked a Facebook post that was critical of that decision. So the third instance there was that the Judicial Inquiry Board found that Adrian lied during questioning about the first two incidents.
Interesting. It's pretty rare, as I mentioned, that a judge would be removed here. What happens next now? Is there a vacancy in the county bench, so to speak?
They've appointed a Calhoun County judge to take up Adrian's docket, and Adrian says he's retiring.
He's retiring. Interesting. All right. Well, that is a fascinating case. Lindsay Jones, let me bring you into the conversation now. You have covered the growing insurance market that focuses on the risks associated with carbon capture technology and storage. This is something we've talked about on the program before. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting to note that there are two industries kind of attempting to and actually growing concurrently. And so as developers have an increased interest in pursuing these carbon capture and storage projects, they're also looking to mitigate any risks associated with that, whether that is a financial risk or that's an environmental risk. And so insurance markets on a larger scale have seen these commercial opportunities, and they have sort of been able to position themselves to offer their services as kind of that intermediary. And I spoke with a representative from one of the largest global brokerages and risk management associations, Marsh in New York City. And he mentioned that these insurance companies are actually going to play kind of a crucial role in helping some of these developers meet their regulatory obligations. So whether that's the EPA or any other state or federal regulatory authorities that they have to answer to, those insurance companies are going to be set to help them navigate through that. And so just thought that that was an interesting parallel of two industries growing at the same time.
Yeah. And I guess so homeowners are they finding that, I mean, is this applying to individuals or is this more of a business level or where is this actually being felt, this difficulty finding insurance?
So I think that the growth of the market is more commercially oriented, and it's more about those commercial developments. But what prompted my interest in this was attending some county level public hearings on a proposed carbon storage project in our area in central Illinois. And there was a landowner, a property owner, who said that when she considered having a well put on her land, her insurance company would no longer cover her property, that they told her that. And she provided a letter speaking to that. And it was difficult to pinpoint to what extent that is a common problem. I don't think that it turned out to be for everyone, but it is possible, according to the representative I spoke to from Marsh, that perhaps as these projects grow, we'll see kind of that market trickle down.
Jane, I want to come back to you now, and I guess this is in a somewhat related vein because it's an environmental story, but there is a lake, a popular lake around Galesburg, that water access has had to close to after a fuel spill. What happened there?
Well, Lake Story is a city-owned lake, and adjacent to it is a property that used to be the state-operated animal disease lab. But that closed in 2017, and the property became state surplus property owned by Central Management Services. But on February 8th, workers in the area of the lake and this property, Galesburg Sanitary District workers, discovered that there was a leak of red dye diesel coming from the generator at this property, and it was leaking into a storm drain, then into a creek, and then to the outfall of Lake Story. So information about this was pretty sparse at first. The city did acknowledge the leak, CMS did acknowledge the leak, but it felt like there was not a lot of detail about the impact. How far did it get? There's been a contractor on site since the day after. But when I got some documents from the Illinois EPA, that started to come into focus a little bit more. This generator had no operational purpose. It wasn't doing anything. It was just sitting there. And when it malfunctioned, the fuel had been leaking for some time to make it that far to the lake, and they did find oil sheen past the outfall of Lake Story. It had migrated further into the lake, and that's when the city decided they were going to close water access. It is a relatively small leak, less than a couple hundred gallons, but the response to it has been going on for 3 weeks now, and it's been pretty intense.
Yeah, I thought that was a unique aspect of this. It's not like this was just detected by doing sampling. You could actually see, or they could see, like that sort of rainbow film that anyone who's, you know, done boating or something like that can be familiar with, where you actually have fuel in the water visible.
Yes, there was sheen in several parts of the lake. And the response to it, like I said, there have been river level booms, creek level booms, hundreds of different booms in different parts of the lake. They've removed at least 12,000 gallons of water and fuel. So again, the response has been really thorough, but just a really unique situation that this is kind of a property that's not used and this happened.
Is this drinking water, or is it more of just a recreational lake?
It's recreational. Yeah. It actually was built by the railroads in the 1920s to supply water for trains. And then it evolved into a recreational lake owned by the city.
All right. Well, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are beginning, as we do most Fridays, with our reporter roundtable talking about news from different parts of the state. Today, we are focusing on Macomb and Galesburg with Jane Carlson, who is a reporter for Tri-States Public Radio, and Bloomington Normal with Lindsay Jones, who's a reporter for WGLT, the public radio station there. And Lindsay, let me come back to you with some of your education stories you've been covering lately. First, you found that it seems like online education is very much here to stay. This is something that really had a big uptick after the pandemic. But say more about that. What is happening in higher education in particular?
Yeah, so I ended up reading a pretty interesting statistic in the Hechinger report, and it was this national statistic that said that like 53% of all college students had taken at least one online course in the past year. And that number was almost twice what it was pre-pandemic, fall of 2019. And so there's a number of implications from this. One is that that online course offering continues to be persistent post-COVID, even though, you know, in-person options are very much more available now than they were back then. But then there's also an implication that that colleges and universities are leaning into online options as a means of preemptively addressing a predicted enrollment cliff. And so that's a term for an expected drop in the number of high school graduates that's expected to start in 2025 and persist going forward. And that's due to lower birth rates from the Great Recession. And so something that a lot of universities and colleges are thinking about is, you know, what can we do to offset that? And so I found, since Illinois State University is in our backyard, there's only a small percentage of ISU students who are taking at least one online course. It's like 4 or 5%. And so this is a relatively unexplored territory. And what they are looking at in order to offset a potential drop in the number of eligible high school students to come into college is to expand online course offerings. And so they're going to, eventually, the plan is to create 3 new online-only master's programs And there's a hope to expand adult education opportunities like micro-credentialing or other professional upskilling. And so the idea is kind of to offer more credit hour dollar options ahead of that projected drop in students.
Maybe there's a class I will be taking someday through ISU. All right. While we are talking about ISU, there was another sort of development there, and that is that tenure and tenure track faculty are officially unionized. What did it take to get to this point? What are the next steps for the union?
Yeah, so it was actually a years-long effort to get to that final unionization. Organization started during the COVID years, and it was just a lot of on-the-ground, one-on-one conversations with as many faculty members as possible. I know the union member that I spoke to said that they were very intentional at trying to reach as many as possible, and that culminated in recognition from the State Educational Labor Relations Board in January. I believe it was just a couple of days ago, the tenure track faculty union entered into its first round of negotiations with the university for its first ever contract. They have a few subsequent negotiating sessions after that as well.
And Jane, let me come back to you. McDonough County, I understand, is looking to build a new animal shelter there, but it needs to raise some money first. So what is the story there?
It does. Well, the shelter is, of course, county operated. And, you know, they pay the bills on this small building that's the current shelter and provide some staffing. But the Humane Society in McDonough County has really all volunteer run. It's really picked up a lot to make sure that the services the animals need are provided, medical procedures. They're really in charge of promoting the adoptions, dealing with the cat population, things like that. And the building that they're in is about 40 years old. It's tiny. The kennels are falling apart. The cats are kind of shoved in a garage without socialization. So this group of volunteers has raised more than half of a $1 million goal to build a new shelter that's kind of more of the 21st century. The idea that it's better for the animals, but is also a better space for volunteers and for people who are going to adopt animals.
Sounds like a pretty significant amount of money for an animal
I
shelter.
Thought so.
Yeah. What do they have any interesting tactics they're planning to use for trying to raise that?
Well, they have an event called Casino Night, which is not gambling with real money, but it actually is a really unique fundraiser, and it's been really successful for them.
Oh, boy, taking me back to my Catholic school education there. But that's a conversation for another day.
Exactly.
Jane, I also wanted to ask you, Jane, about a teacher in Monmouth-Roseville District 238, say that three times fast, who's getting some recognition. What can you tell us about her?
Yes, Sarah Mendez was named the State Board of Education's Bilingual Teacher of the Year. So I went and visited her. She teaches a 8th grade language development class in the Monmouth-Roseville School District, which is a really unique district. It's a consolidated district, part farming, part small community. It has about 1,600 students, but nearly one in five is an English language learner. So one of the things that was most interesting was talking to Sarah about how bilingual education has evolved in that district, where 15 years ago, she was primarily working with Spanish-speaking students who had intermediate language skills. And now in this district, 25 different languages are spoken. There are 20 different birth countries. And just since the start of winter break, the district has welcomed students from Guatemala, Mexico, Guinea, Malaysia, and Yemen.
That is fascinating. And this is, I mean, to emphasize this point, this is a pretty rural district, right? Small towns, you said.
It is. I mean, Monmouth is about 9,000 and Roseville is about 900.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. All right. Jane Carlson is a reporter with WIUM Tri-States Public Radio. And Lindsay Jones is a reporter at WGLT, Bloomington Normal Public Radio. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I will mention, you know, here we would love to hear what you think about what we've been talking about on the 21st Show, be it today's program or anything from the recent past. If you liked it, if you didn't like it, if you think we got something right or wrong for whatever reason, you can always leave us a voicemail anytime at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Anytime day or night, 217-300-2121. We will be sharing some of your responses on air from time to time. You can find that number and our email address and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. Also like to mention, coming up on Monday's program, we're going to be talking about crime and perception. Government numbers show violent crime has been dropping significantly, but people still think crime is on the rise. We're going to dig into those numbers and why they don't always move public opinion. Plus, a bird native to Hawaii is on the verge of extinction with just a handful left in the wild. Why are we talking about that here in Illinois? Well, there's a researcher from Central Illinois who's working to save the Akekeke bird from becoming another footnote in history. Coming up here on the 21st show, President Trump has been removed from the ballot, although that court order was stayed. We're going to be talking about that case, as well as our look at national politics in our political roundtable. It's all coming up after a short break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.